People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this edition of the program, we take a front lines look at the topic of education with our guest, California school teacher Steve Miller.
The current educational system that we have was created for the industrial era. That era is passing away, and consequently, the educational system that we have is also passing away. This is the crisis that we're looking at, and within this crisis, various agendas are being put forward.
That, plus our featured commentary on People's Tribune Radio. But first, these news stories from Nicole Trejo.
From Agribusiness Examiner, while the USDA was reporting that retail food prices have risen 7% over the past 3 years, as the cost of commodities like wheat, corn, and cattle has fallen 10%, corporate agribusinesses like IBP and Philip Morris were reporting sizable profits. Leading meatpacker IBP alone reports up to 126% increase in the second quarter. At the same time corporate agribusiness is prospering, the nation's farmers are looking at still another price depression, as the USDA recently lowered its projected prices for wheat by 15 cents a bushel and for corn and soybeans by 5 cents. Soybean prices will be the lowest they've been since the early 1970s. While farmers get 21 cents of each dollar Americans spend on food, Philip Morris gets 10 cents of every American dollar, and ConAgra, the nation's largest food manufacturer, gets an estimated 6 cents of every food dollar. And in the battle for the airwaves, the National Association of Broadcasters has claimed that low-power FM stations will cause massive interference in 60 radio markets. But a study by Micropower Radio Advocates states that low-power FM radio service will not lead to a significant increase in interference with current full-power stations. The receiver engineering study was conducted by Broadcast Signal Lab. And finally, from Insight, the DEA uses this list, though not exclusively, to justify profiled drug searches on airplanes and in airports. Arrived in the afternoon. Was one of the first to deplane. Was one of the last to deplane. Deplaned in the middle. Purchased ticket at airport. Made reservation on short notice. Bought coach ticket. Bought first class ticket. Used one-way ticket. Used round-trip ticket. Carried no luggage. Carried brand new luggage. Carried a small bag. Carried a medium-sized bag. Carried two bulky garment bags. Carried two heavy suitcases, carried four pieces of luggage, dissociated self from luggage, traveled alone, traveled with a companion, acted too nervous, acted too calm, walked quickly through the airport, walked slowly through the airport.
Well, that sure sounds like the unfriendly skies to me. Thanks, Nikki. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. September means a return of millions of students to schools all across America. The topic of education, which is oft debated, sometimes fiercely, is our topic today. We regularly hear from politicians, administrators, and lobbyists about education and the state of our schools, but rarely from frontline teachers. Our guest is one of those teachers from Oakland, California, Steve Miller. Steve, welcome to People's Tribune Radio.
Thank you, Mike.
Can you let our listeners know a little bit about where you teach and why you got involved in teaching?
Well, I teach science in Oakland, California. It's an inner city school. It's basically part of a school system that provides a third world education to most of the students. And for me, it wasn't such a high moral calling so much as I needed a job transition, and this was the community I lived in, and I couldn't see anything better than teaching high school here, so I teach about 8 blocks from my house.
Can you talk about a day in the life of an Oakland school and an Oakland school student and an Oakland school teacher?
Well, it's very variable. In my school, there's really a line that's drawn down the middle of the school. On one side of the line are the teachers who recognize that the real problems in the school come from the adults, not from the kids. I mean, yes, we have gangs. Yes, we have kids who are hungry. We have horrible health care problems. Those are problems of life under America in as we enter the year 2000. But the lack of cooperation, the corruption of the administrators, the way that they not so much the site administrators but the school district administrators legally steal the money and divert it into various things. This is what pollutes the and destroys the educational efforts. So consequently, you have teachers who have absolutely no problem with kids. I haven't kicked a kid out of class in 3 years, and I didn't kick any. I kicked one kid out the year before, and 3 years before that, I haven't kicked a kid out. We have other teachers who kick out 10 or 15 a day. What this really is that the kids simply, even though they're ignorant, they have a gut feeling that what they're getting is not good enough, and they're in rebellion against it. And I frankly don't think that there's something wrong with that. It's just that the old type teaching just doesn't work any longer. It's a new generation and it's a new era.
When you say they give most of the students a third world education, what do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at the economics of it, you can see it clearly. California spends about $4,000 a year per student, but it spends $35,000 a year to jail these students. Now, 70% of these students are jailed for nonviolent crimes. In other words, we're paying the equivalent of a Harvard education to jail these people for nonviolent crimes, but we can't possibly come up with the money that would provide a quality education, especially a quality education that makes sense in light of the new technology that's transforming this country.
When we begin to talk about a topic like education, it begins to become a very, very multifaceted and complex topic. And can you talk a little bit about the whole issue of where our schools are and perhaps where you think they should be and how the various social and economic and political factors play into education in schools from your perspective as a frontline teacher in Oakland, California?
Well, you're certainly correct. What's going on in public education is highly complex. It can be very confusing. It's a gamut, almost a chaotic swirl of issues from class size to testing to school violence to vouchers to college choices. I mean, there's so many issues there. It's hard to see what's going on behind this and what's driving the process forward. Before we get to that, though, I think that regardless of anything else we can say, one thing is for sure about public education. It's built the world as we know it. There's no question, if you compare the educational level of the United States now to 1899, where something like a third of the people could read, where people had no sense of culture, no sense of the world that we live in, you can see that public education is really, it's the unalterable foundation of democracy. Public education has not only provided the skilled workers and the training that has allowed people to produce the technology that makes our world the way it is, it's enriched our cultural level tremendously. It's really increased our sense of humanity and what that means. This is really an important issue because we are at a nexus of time where the right to equal quality public education is being withdrawn in this country. And this is the issue that we find behind every single one of the sub little issues that happen here. In every case, I think people have to look at it and say, does this mean that the public education is being extended or public education is being limited?
We're talking with Steve Miller, a teacher from Oakland, California, and we're talking about schools and education. Steve, when you talked about the process of public education, the availability of that, the access to that being eliminated, what do you mean by that?
Well, for over 150 years in this country, the question of equal quality public education has been probably one of the two or three single most important political demands that's been raised. Since the Civil War, it's been the absolute central question of the African people's movement in this country. If you can imagine the Civil War when it ended in 1865, fewer than 25% of the people could read, but new industry was being built throughout the North. The question of education really meant the question of equal access to the future. The current educational system that we have was created for the industrial era. That era is passing away, and consequently, the educational system that we have is also passing away. This is the crisis that we're looking at, and within this crisis, various agendas are being put forward. You can't really separate an educational system from its economic context. In 1899, 60% of the people in this country worked in agriculture. In 1950, 60% of the people worked in manufacturing. Now in 1999, 60% of the people work in the knowledge industry or are information workers. These are people who use electronics, whether computers or electronic sensing devices, to program information. This is as true for animal veterinarians as it is for automobile mechanics. It's just something that it's a technology which is coming in. It can't be stopped because if it's used right, it makes life easier for everybody. On the other hand, it also can be used incorrectly, and in the case of education, this is the underlying thing that's transforming the situation. The seven-period day where students were conceived of as parts that moved down the assembly line from teacher to teacher, and each teacher poured their knowledge in. This is the classic. That system is passé, and in fact, it's dying rapidly. Interestingly enough, in the period of time since this was put in, we've learned a few things about teaching, and we really know today how to teach. Current research on the human brain shows that the foundation of the old system of education is completely bogus. That idea was that intelligence is innate in a human being. This is what most of us were raised up in, and this is the way it's still framed today. In other words, if you're smart, you're smart, and if you're not, you're not. You're not going to get it. In fact, if the various different kinds of intelligence are addressed and people are taught in groups in a situation where the teaching is relevant, we find that everybody can learn. What's interesting about this is that the old idea that education should serve the talented tenth is also passé. This idea was first formulated by Thomas Jefferson, who said that at one level you take the top 10th percent, and you move them up to the next level, and you take the top 10% of those, and so on and so forth. So we're facing a situation where, in fact, we finally have got the data and the information to know that we really can raise everybody to a much higher level of education than most of us have today. Of course, this process is driven by electronics, and electronics is producing a quantity of information that doubles every 18 months. It's done so for 20 years. What this means is it's impossible to memorize all of this stuff. So education is changing very rapidly away from rote learning, drills, and memorization to training people in critical thinking, training them to be lifelong learners who can use the technology to get the information that they need. And what's ironic about this is that just when it's truly possible to offer everybody the world and even more, public education is being cut back. What describes the situation is that the United States was the very first country to begin a public education, and it's also the first country that's beginning to end it. This is a very strange contradiction, but what drives this forward is the fact that it's today cheaper to build a computer than it is to educate a human mind. We've seen computers eliminate unskilled manual labor. The next phase was the elimination of unskilled clerical labor. Middle managers soon followed. And electronics is just in its infancy. It's going to replace labor at all levels. What it can't do is replace people who are learning. And that's what is the central issue here. For our society, it's actually not cheaper to build such a computer. When we say it's cheaper, we're only looking at it from the point of view of private property, private profit, I mean. But private profit is what is the driving element in how our country is organized. So the true potential of this technology and the true potential of what we know about education is going to be restricted down, just as the workforce is restricted now, to a few high-tech engineers and the vast majority of people for whom skills are not even provided any longer. And we live in a society which really has very little value for what human beings can contribute. A computer cannot take a five-year-old and train that kid to be a productive part of a group. It's a tool which can assist in that process, but it takes a human mind to guide that process. That's what teachers are, and in fact, that's what parents are. I mean, we've all done that kind of teaching in our lives, and we're not going to see computers take that over. Computers are going to take over the numbers crunching and the information processing, and that's great. That's great. It opens us up to provide the rest of what society is so lacking. One of the interesting questions here is, how did things get to this juncture? How did this crisis, much of which is objective given the fact that a new technology is coming in, how did it get this way where decisions are being made constantly to undercut the breadth of equal quality education and cut it back? Well, the debate really began 20 years ago in the early 80s as to which way public education should go. And at that time, an interesting assumption was made. There was no discussion, there was no vote, but American business was given the right to set the educational agenda. American business came in and stated, this is what we want, A, B, C, D, and that determined the direction that the new concepts of education were developed. But this assumption needs to be challenged. Why should these people have the right to determine this? After all, they send their kids to private schools. What makes them experts on public education? These are also people who openly defend their right to destroy the environment in the name of profits. These are people who today blatantly push programs like ending welfare, which obviously increase child poverty. How can these people stand for what public education should be when they're in favor of increasing child poverty? It just doesn't make sense. Beginning actually this fall on October 15th, the first wave of families who were cut off of welfare will become absolutely and completely indigent. They will never be able to receive public money again, period. What impact is that going to have on public schools? The bigger wave is going to hit next July, 30 months after TANF was put in, the new welfare changes. That, frankly, I think is going to destroy urban public schools, because in my school, 70% of the families are on welfare. What's going to happen when these people are completely indigent? Are the kids still going to be able to go to school? I mean, they're not even going to be eligible to receive food in school at that point, as far as we know today.
When you're talking about the issue of American education being turned over to big business, I'm thinking of a program. I may have it wrong, but I thought I heard it referred to as something called Goals 2000 or something like that, whereby it sounded to me that a major component of that program was to allow business to dictate more or less what actually would be taught in schools, looking forward at their workforce needs in the future as compared towards looking at real educational goals for the students coming through the school system. I mean, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, in 1991, the U.S. Department of Labor issued what's called the SCANS report. The SCANS report defines a process which is completing itself today, where every major branch of industry will define what are called the standards that they want for the workers who work in their industry. Interestingly enough, this is all designed for people who are portable workers who will change jobs constantly. The SCANS report is very interesting and is the foundation for educational reform in the last 10 years. There's good educational stuff in it because we know a lot more about teaching, but the bottom line of it is that it's not being financed equally. The history of public education is really important because it shows why American business can really make no honest claim to be the people who decide its direction. Back in 1830, there was no public education at all. This was because one of the major sections of the workforce were children. Child labor was legal in this country. Children were worked 12 to 15 hours a day. Experts declared that the childhood ended at 6 years old. And American business was completely opposed to education because it would take away these people who were paid almost nothing. So it was also a capital crime at that time to teach the slaves how to read. This was the period of slavery, and that shows you right there the importance, the liberating potential of knowledge. After the Civil War, as I said before, the demand for equal and quality public education really became a major demand throughout the country. This also coincided with the needs of capital. At that time, U.S. industry was really tooling up for the large-scale mining, steel, railroad, and ultimately the automobile industry. They needed skilled workers. Consequently, they needed an educational system that was going to train skilled workers so that the businesses themselves didn't have to pay for this. At that time, you had machinists who would take a block of steel and be able to cut a gear or a series of parts out of that. They had to be able to visualize this. They were taught trigonometry, even though they could barely read. This was not an educational problem of the era. And then they would put the steel on a lathe and cut it out. This was something that was entirely doable. The result of this was the creation in the 20s of the 6 or 7 period day, which was a development of this to match the industrial system based on the assembly line. Schools were extended from more than the 8th grade, which was the norm at that time, to high school, because they recognized they needed more literate people to work in factories. After World War II, you had the GI Bill of Rights passed, which many people call the most important legislation to be passed in this country in the 20th century, because it educated a huge number of people in the working class. It gave them free access to the university, and that is what's transformed our world up to this point. Community colleges quickly followed. Now, all of a sudden, we see the reverse, that education is being withdrawn. And this makes perfect sense when you realize that the powers that be, the captains of industry, don't really expect to have and don't want to have an educated workforce anymore. So they're not going to pay for it this time around either. Consequently, it's being cut back. Obviously, the education of the people of a country is one of the major issues for any country at any period of time. If we have an intelligent and creative people who are highly trained and highly cultured, we're going to get far more out of them. They're going to produce far more things of benefit to society than a society where public education is reduced ultimately to what there's a bill now in Florida to completely end public education, to just abolish public schools and only have private schools. This was the way it was when 15 or 20% of the people could read. This is completely in contradiction to what we need and what, in fact, is our right as an American, to have truly equal, truly quality public education paid for as part of a national plan to develop our country. Clearly, access in this country to all social services is being cut back. Clearly, access to reading, writing, to being able to get penicillin or having your asthma taken care of is being reduced to whether or not you can pay for it. And this is taking this country backwards way before the Civil War. It's something which is just not acceptable, and I think it also provides a direction for the struggles around public education, which take place on many, many fronts. But they're always tied to the question of whether people have equal access to health, to food, to shelter, to culture. It always relates to the issue of censorship. And these are the issues that behind the gamut of daily issues and conflicts that we see in almost every city and in every state in this country, these are the issues which are behind that. I think it's certainly true, and I think we can see this no matter what movement we look at in our country. The powers that be do not intend to take this forward and make it more democratic and to give more access. Everything that they offer is taking it in the other direction. Consequently, the only people who are going to be able to move this forward are the people who are being shut out of the process. Those are the students that I teach. Those are the students in every major city in this country. It includes their parents. These are the families who are part of the rural poor. We're seeing a new segregation in this country between the suburbs on one side and the cities and then the countryside on the other side. And the suburbs, public education works great for them. It doesn't work for the majority of the people in this country, and that's where the solutions are going to come from. It isn't going to come from some politician who has to raise $1 million a month in order to get elected. These are huge issues which are going to be issues that people have to rally around and fight for, and we have to begin to see that these issues are tied together from the perspective of the people who are being disenfranchised.
Steve Miller, thank you for being with us on the program to give us a frontline perspective on education and schools here on People's Tribune Radio.
Thank you, Mike.
And now, Liz Monhay of the People's Tribune with our featured monthly commentary.
I remember a particular afternoon, Sherry coming into my office in an absolute panic. Sherry's a returning adult student, a single mom with two kids, an honor roll GPA of 3.8, and typifies the example of someone trying to achieve the American dream. But what happens when the system starts to fail? Her quandary? She's been forced to put off her educational dream of becoming a nurse, to work the 20 to 30 hour requirement under welfare reform. It's been about 2 years since that fateful afternoon, and Sherry has yet to enroll in her dream of becoming a nurse. She works the graveyard shift so she can continue with school and make time for her kids. She's had to give up extracurricular activities like the school paper that had blossomed her so. All the things that make you a well-rounded student. You can see the wear and tear in her eyes. In that process, her GPA has dropped, and many opportunities have been missed. I wish this story were an exception. Countless are the lives that come through my office in this predicament. The middle-class suburban housewife going through a divorce. The mid-manager who's been downsized at a company he's worked for 30 years and now needs to start a new life. The 18-year-old who wants to be a full-time student but has to work full-time to pay for education. All students struggling to meet their basic needs. In this process, not only are public education and higher education under siege by politicians and technocrats who want to privatize it, but so is the student. Increasingly, high school students and first-time college students are working more hours than ever. At our college alone, most of our students are now part-time, majority women, and the average age is 29. How we as a society understand what a student is has totally changed. Today, a student has a new face and many more complex issues and pressures to deal with. These new students are products of a new rising class in America, a product of automation, and they have to deal with the destruction of society's safety net, the elimination of welfare, healthcare, immigration, and the downsizing of America as powerful corporations seek profits in a global market. Something has gone fundamentally wrong when you have so many lives struggling to achieve the American dream, to educate and better themselves, and all the odds are stacked against them. Something has to fundamentally change. Education is supposed to be about learning, contributing to society, about growing as a person. One of the meanings of the word university is wisdom. Education has been reduced to much less. In many instances, it is only a hope for survival in a society that can no longer guarantee opportunities for all. What will this do to our future, our children, our culture? What will become of humankind if education continues to only be defined as a job in an increasingly jobless world? I don't even want to imagine. I would rather think of the endless possibilities of constructing a world that has the audacity to provide us all with the opportunities to learn and contribute to the wisdom of a better world.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publish the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. If you'd like more information about the League, its newspapers, or how to order cassette copies of People's Tribune Radio, you can contact us at 1-800-691-6888. That number, 1-800-691-6888. On behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America and Nicole Trejo, my name is Mike Thornton. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.